What I will do, I'm going to go, I mean, I want to get the geometric side into a stopping point. I'm going to be more sketchy today than I was before, but I still hope I can give you an idea of the third, this is the third step of calculating, to actually calculate the integral over GQ mod GA1 of KT O of X DX, to try to calculate this explicitly. And remember here, O is restricted to consist of a single semi-simple conjugacy class. In GQ. And so we did two things last time, quite easy things. I didn't do the whole proof, but they're really not terribly difficult, and I tried to give the main idea for them. So the final step, then, this would in fact give you the value of JTO of F. So how would we go about doing this? This consists only of one semi-simple conjugacy class, so why not just fix an element in that conjugacy class? Everything else in O would be conjugate to it. So, in fact, why don't we fix an element from this conjugacy class in a nice way? Let's fix it so that it lies in the smallest possible parabolic subgroup. So, in other words, let's fix a pair P1, gamma 1, where gamma 1 lies in the Levy component of MP1Q intersection O. It's a class, it's an element in this conjugacy class in the given Levy component, and where P is as small as possible, is minimal. Not a minimal parabolic subgroup, but minimal among the parabolic subgroups that intersect the class O. With respect to this condition. Now, there is a technical matter, a minor technical matter at this point. We're going to be wanting to look at the centralizer, G sub gamma 1. I mean, I can, if I write it like this, I'm meaning just an algebraic group. It's going to be defined over Q, the centralizer in G of gamma 1. So this is an algebraic group, and it is possibly a disconnected group. It's possibly Zariski disconnected. Would have finitely many connected components, but it might not be connected. So it's a possibly Zariski connected algebraic group over Q. But I won't stop to prove this, but it's quite easy to show that its connected component, the connected component of 1, whose identity component G, let's write that as G gamma 1 upper 0, that's also an algebraic group over Q, that this actually is contained. Gamma 1 O consists entirely of semi-simple classes. There's no unipotent class that commutes with gamma 1, and we've embedded gamma 1 in the smallest possible parabolic subgroup. Those two conditions, if you think about it, tell you that the connected component of the centralizer, the identity component of the centralizer, is contained in fact, the Levy component. Not just the centralizer, the connected component of the centralizer in G is actually contained in the Levy component. So the minor technical matter that I need to say, it's possible, however, that the non-connected components might not be contained in MP1. And I'm going to just impose that as an assumption. Remember, I'm trying to calculate these distributions for, in some sense, almost all O. And this further assumption is not a generic condition. The further assumption is, let me ask that G, the full group, G gamma 1, be contained in MP1. Now, this would always be true if G is GLN, or more generally, if the I'm just going to write this down. I'm running short of time, so I mean the derived group of G. If the derived group of G is simply connected, that's a property that GLN has. Any group with that property, in fact, is such that the centralizer of any semi-simple element is actually connected. So, in general, it is really a modest restriction. It's a further restriction and a modest restriction on O. But even with that restriction, the O that we're considering are, in some sense, almost all of them. And then with this condition, then the centralizer, well, if I were to take the centralizer of gamma 1 in GQ, that would be contained in MP1. And so, in particular, the centralizer of gamma 1 in the larger group GQ is contained in, is equal to its centralizer in the smaller group, MP1. So this is now just a sketch of an argument. What I guess I hope to persuade you is that there should be a very nice, you would expect to be able to calculate this. And I'm going to go through the steps, but leaving some of the calculations, just stating some of the calculations. So what we have to do, the main kind of one of the main terms in KT tilde O is this this kernel, but modified. And so that this is the function at x, which is equal to the sum over gamma in, this is for any parabolic, so the sum over gamma in MPQ intersection O, the sum, and then the sum over nu in NPQ, rather than the integral, mu, mu, x. And once again, this is what we started doing when we were fixing a class O. So this could, of course, be empty, in which case this would be zero. But in any case, that's what it is. Now, the thing that makes it work, that allows you fairly easily to calculate this integral, is that everything in this sum, and the more general sums that you put in to give you K tilde TO, they're all, as functions of X, are functions on one semisimple conjugacy class. And that's because we've taken a sum here rather than an integral. After all, we can write this, we can rewrite that as the sum over gamma, same sum over gamma there, but I can write it as, let me write it now, eta in NPQ of f of x to the minus 1, eta to the minus 1, nu eta of x. I can, that sum over nu, I can, if I conjugate mu by something in n, I'm going to get mu times something in n. And if it's just easy to convince yourself that because the centralizer of gamma, any one of these gammas, excuse me, I'm going to be writing things down wrong. I better watch myself. Sorry, that's a gamma, not a mu. This is a gamma, not a mu. Excuse me. And so since the centralizer of any one of these gammas in NP is 1, then there is no, these conjugates of gamma are all going to be different. And it's easy to persuade yourself from the fact that you get precisely all multiples of gamma by elements in NPQ. All right, now these elements gamma in here, the intersection of O with MP, they are also all conjugate. So I can write them all as conjugates of any of a given element, in particular this element gamma 1 that we've fixed. It is true because we are picking an equivalence class O that cannot be, pardon me? Well, sorry, this step here is this is by the conditions on O. So remember, O is an equivalence class that contains only semi-simple elements. And remember, the general equivalence classes consist of a semi-simple conjugacy class and then all possible unipotent classes that commute with it. And since N consists of unipotent elements, there can't be any element in N that commutes with any of these gammas. So that's the condition on O. All right, so every one of these gammas is conjugate to gamma 1. Now, it might not be, I'd like to actually write it as a sum over MPQ. So not everything here is MP conjugate to gamma 1. But so there are going to be finitely many MP conjugacy classes in that sum over gamma. In fact, you can write this finite set of MP conjugacy classes, you can parameterize it by a certain subset, and I'm not going to define this, you can write it down explicitly. This is a certain subset of the Weyl group, a certain finite subset of the Weyl group, and then we're going to have I'll write it here first. We'll leave a space there. F of x to the minus 1, eta to the minus 1. And now I'm going to take mu. I'm going to take mu summed over elements in MP of Q. But there will be a centralizer and I'm going to put gamma 1 here. But I won't take gamma 1. I'll rather take the finite set of conjugates of gamma 1 by these elements in the Weyl group. And then I can get mu eta x. So what would this be then? This would be elements in MPQ modulo, the centralizer in MPQ of this point, WS. Gamma 1 WS to the minus 1. So that's the quotient of MPQ by that thing. And then we've got the sum over mu in NPQ. Okay, so where W P1P is a certain, which one could write down easily, but I won't take the time to do so. It's just a certain subset of the Weyl group. So if you do it like this, then this is good, because here's a sum over the unipotent radical, and there's a sum over the Levy component. So we can simplify that as simply writing it as a sum over S in this space. And then let's combine the two of them. Let's take it as a sum over pi in the quotient by MPQ WS gamma 1 WS to the minus 1 times PQ, divided into PQ, of f of x to the minus 1, pi to the minus 1, WS gamma 1, WS to the minus 1, pi of x. All right, so there we're up on the top board. Let's just say then what we... I mean, that's a pretty good formula for the kernel. Everything in that, it's a sum, basically, over elements in the conjugacy class of gamma 1. So we've got something. We'll put that into our formula for K tilde. And we've got something into which we can put that that we know is integrable over X. So K tilde T of O of X is therefore going to be the sum over P minus 1 times the dimension of AP mod AG. The sum, this is just the definition, sum over delta in PQ mod GQ of that thing there. So that's the sum over S in that set. The sum corresponding sum over pi in that set of f of x to the minus 1, delta to the minus 1, pi to the minus 1, ws, gamma 1, ws to the minus 1, pi, delta, x. And then we've got our tau p hat hp delta x. Minus P. Well, that's good. See, there we've got a sum over GQ mod PQ, and we've got a sum over pi in PQ mod something smaller. So let's combine the two of those things. We actually don't have a pi here, but remember, HP is left invariant under PQ, so I can put a pi in there. And then I can combine these two things to be a sum over GQ mod that smaller group there. And I'm going to do that in the same step. What I can then do is conjugate that sum over GQ mod the small thing by WS. I can put the WS, I can get rid of the WS, so I'm going fast, I can get rid of the WS from here and put it, I'm replacing pi by WS pi, so that puts the WS there. Then I would have to change the centralizer group, not to be the centralizer of WS gamma 1, WS minus 1, but no WS at all. So what does that get when you combine it? It's the sum over delta in the centralizer in MP1 of gamma 1, not the WS gamma 1 WS to the minus 1. And it's the it's this divided into GQ of F. So I'm combining these two together. So it's X to the minus 1, delta to the minus 1. And I'm taking the WS out of there and putting it in here. So it's gamma 1, delta, x, whatever. The advantage of doing that is that this thing doesn't depend on S. So the S and the P and the minus sign all can go into a sum of these things. So let's just write it as chi P1 of T delta of x, where chi p1 of t of any element y, it's going to be taking y to be delta x, but of any element y, is simply the sum over p of minus 1 to the dimension of a p mod a g, sum over s in this finite that WP1 over P of simply tau P hat HP WS Y minus T. That's what that is. Now this is, I haven't said what this set is. I mentioned that sometimes P might not occur in this if O intersection P is empty. Well, that is would be reflected in this set. It depends on P1 and on P, and that set might be empty if P is too small relative to P1. But that would be zero. But in any case, it's a sum of characteristic functions. So actually, that looks pretty good. I mean, I hope I can convince you that even if it might be hard to figure out combinatorially what this is, it's an alternating sum of characteristic functions, a double sum actually, over P and over elements in the Weyl group. And that's sitting here. That's just some sum of characteristic functions. But then you've got just the kind of thing that you had in the case of compact quotient. You've got the sum of all conjugates, GQ conjugates, of gamma 1. So we know that the integral of that over GA mod GQ or GA1 mod GQ has to converge. So whatever this is, it's got to help us. It's got to somehow bail us out of whatever divergence would be in that integral if you didn't have the chi P1T. In particular, it better, in some sense, have some sort of compact support. So, J O T of F is then going to be the integral. By definition, it's the integral over GA1 mod GQ of K tilde T O of X dx. So I can combine that. There's a sum over GQ mod something smaller, so I can combine the integral with the sum. And you might say, how do you know you can do that? And I'm not completely justifying it, but let me just say that I'll quote in a minute actually what this chi PT is, how you can compute, what the combinatorics allow you to compute, and it'll be positive. It'll be a positive function. And so you could take F to be positive too. And we know that the resulting thing is absolutely convergent. And so if F were positive and that's positive, then you could combine this with that because everything's positive. So we can do that. And so we get the integral over MP1Q gamma 1 GA1 of F of X to the minus 1 gamma 1 of X chi P1T of X dx. Combining the integral with the sum over delta. And now let's, as a final step, let's do what we did in the case of compact quotient. Let's replace this centralizer of gamma in some the rational points in the centralizer of gamma by the adelic points in the centralizer of gamma. So this would be, we would divide out by MP1A, centralizer of gamma 1. Well, actually, I guess this would be in GA, and I guess I better intersect this with GA1. So then we would have GA there. And then over, then we would have the integral over MP1Q gamma 1 into MP1Q gamma 1 intersection GA1 there of F of X to the minus 1. I mean, the reason for doing this, just as we did the very first day in the case of compact quotient, so this is going to be a variable n. I'm going to be replacing x by xm, m to the minus 1 there, in here. But this still commutes with gamma 1, so I don't need an m there. So it's still f of x to the minus 1 gamma 1 of x, chi p1t, but I really am going to need an m there. So dm dx. GA1, yes. GA1. Incidentally, this thing here, if we wanted, I mean, we it's probably a little nicer to simply write, we could put the split component of the center of GA1 in it back in, because it would still occur in the centralizer. That would still be occur in the centralizer of MP1A gamma 1 there. I could put both the AGR upper 0 in here, and as long as I put it in there. And in fact, this would be the same thing as simply GA gamma 1 modulo, GA modulo this thing without the 1s on it. And then remember, this is the same thing as the centralizer of gamma 1, in fact, in all of GA. So in fact, this is just the kind of thing that we have in the case of compact quotient. Now, this is not the same as, this is bigger, this is strictly bigger than the centralizer of MP1 in gamma upper 1. This is where you shave off the entire split component of the center of MP1, whereas here you're just taking off the split component of the center of G. And it's that thing that would be causing the divergence if we didn't have this thing here, because that would be the difference between this and this is infinite measure, and so you'd be commuting with this and you'd have infinite volume. That was the thing that caused the divergence in that original example that we did for SL2. So it's this thing that's going to bail us out. Whatever this sum of characteristic functions is, it better be compactly supported in the component, the HP1 component of this group. And it is. So I'm just going to state that as a lemma. In fact, it's a rather nice function in that AP component. So for any x, the function m chi p1t of mx, that's that function that's on the right there. This depends, well, the first assertion is more or less just from the definition. It depends only on the image, say H1, in other words, HP1 of M in AP1 of G. It doesn't depend on the rest of M. But more to the point, as a function of H1 in this vector space, it's in fact a characteristic function of a compactly supported function on this vector space. And what is it? It's the characteristic function of actually a convex hull. The convex hull in A P 1 of G of the projection. Onto AP1G of the finite set. So there's some combinatorics in this lemma that I'm skipping. There's the definition up there. I haven't even told you what that WP1P is, but there is a nice description of what it is. And so it's clear there's going to be some interesting combinatorics trying to figure out what that alternating double sum of characteristic functions is going to look like as a function, say, of the HP1 P1 component of M. And so it's, but it's more elaborate than any of the little diagrams. For SL3, for example, it's more elaborate than any of the little diagrams we've written down so far. I could, if I had more time, I could draw you a picture of how it works out. But the answer is that it's the characteristic function in here of the finite set of points y sub s, depending on elements in the vial group. So let me, we'll leave a space here. It's elements s where you take all possible parabolic subgroups P1 prime, like we did in Eisenstein series, and then you take elements s in this vial set of isomorphisms from AP1 to AP1 prime. So there's the set of points S. That's different than that set over there. And what is it? You, for any one of those S, you take S to the minus 1 of T. Okay, that's another point. Maybe not in the positive chamber anymore, an A0. Minus S to the minus 1 H of WS of X, H P1 prime of this. So these are points, well, this is a point that's in A0, but I would take this finite set of points and I would project it onto AP1 of G. So you've got a bunch of little vertices and you take its convex hull. So this is, this proof of this lemma is in the Duke Journal paper. Page 5, page 951, and it refers to a lemma in an earlier paper in Inventiones. '76, so it's corollary 3-5. So it is compactly supported in H1. And so we're going to be integrating. We would have to integrate over H1. So let me write Vm1 of T of X for the volume in this convex, in AP1G. Of this convex hull. So that's going to be what comes in to our integral. And so this is strictly bigger than this. So if I integrate over the H1, then the kernel of that would be this thing here. That's the thing that this would no longer depend on, and certainly this doesn't depend on it. So why don't I set? Let me write G A gamma 1 upper 1. So I don't mean the centralizer of gamma in G A 1. I rather mean the centralizer of gamma in G A, and then I take the 1. In other words, I mean M P 1 A gamma 1 1. I mean the set of M in MP1A gamma 1 such that HP1M is 0. The kernel of HP up there that thing doesn't depend on. And then we get, our answer is that JTO of F is then the volume of this thing, because nothing in that integral depends on this smaller group. So it's the volume of GQ gamma 1 divided into GA gamma 1 1 of the integral. So it's nicest, I guess, to write the integral over this thing here. So it's the integral over GA gamma 1 divided into GA of F of X to the minus 1 gamma 1, x, v, m1, p of x, dx. So it's not an invariant orbital integral over gamma 1, but an integral weighted by a rather interesting function of x. And in fact, it gets a little more interesting if we make the thing independent of t. So remember, this is where you set t equal to t1. So let me write vm1 of x to be the volume of that convex hull up there, which you can define for any t. Let me take it to be at t1. And then, in fact, a little thing happens, just a minor little thing, but a thing that helps us along the way, and that is that this v1, so I mentioned that this point t1 is a point that is a unique point that in a certain sense is well situated with respect to the choice of maximal compact subgroup. This would be true for all t, but we know that that's a polynomial in t, and then by the nature of that convex hull, you see that its volume is also going to be a polynomial in t, and so you're allowed to set t equal to anything you want, and you will maintain this identity here. So this, what is this? This is the volume, and so this is just a fact. This is the volume in AP1G of the convex hull of the projection onto AP1G of the point. Well, what are they? We could set t equal to t1 up there, and what would we get? We'd get something involving t1 with that thing on the right. But actually, it gets better than that. It's what you get is minus, there's no t1 at all if you write it like this. You get minus s to the minus 1 h p1 prime ws tilde of x, where s P1 prime varies, and S ranges over W AP1, AP1 prime. So you'd think you'd have to have a T1 up there for the finite set of points at which you're taking the volume of the convex hull. But what I have done is to change WS, that's the representative of the Weyl group element in GQ. Now, if you think about it, that's not a very good thing to have in an integral that you want to somehow regard as a local object. We really, the whole aim of all of this is to write the geometric side in objects which are as local as possible. Now, if I have a representative of S in GQ, that's not very local. What I would rather have a representative of S in would be something in the maximal compact subgroup at each place that normalizes A0 and acts like the Weyl group element S. And that's what WS is. You can't, in general, pick, you can for GLN, but in general, you cannot pick a representative of a Weyl group that is simultaneously in GQ and in the maximal compact subgroup. So WS, is a representative of S in K. This is regarded as an element in GA, as a subgroup of GA. Therefore, it normalizes the adelic points on A0 rather than what it was up above, rather than in GQ, and embedded diagonally. In GA. So actually, at this point T1, this point T1 does another thing for you. It measures the discrepancy between choosing representatives of vial group elements in GQ and choosing them in a maximal compact, adelic maximal compact subgroup. Now, you think for GLN, if you think about GLN for a moment, you'll see that you can choose a representative of any vial group element by a permutation matrix, which is simultaneously in GQ and in the canonical maximal compact subgroup. And it's for that reason, that's one of the reasons why T1 is equal to 0 for GLN. If you choose another maximal compact subgroup of GLN, you might not be able to do that. And so, in any case, the resulting volume Vm of X is something that's more local in that sense. This is it, by the way, this little argument, this is in this Annals paper. You know, this last fact in the Annals paper. It's a very simple argument, actually, which I would give if I had more time. But so, conclusion. Under the conditions above, on O, J, O of F is the volume of G Q gamma 1 divided into G A gamma 1 1 integral G A gamma 1 G A F of X to the minus 1 gamma 1 X times the volume of this convex hull. And so this is is a weighted orbital integral. You get a much more explicit and locally much more local object attached to almost every term on the geometric side. I mean, just a couple of examples. If suppose that P1, the smallest parabolic subgroup that intersects O, suppose that happens to equal G. Well, in other words, this would mean that O intersection P is empty for every proper parabolic subgroup. Okay, then Vm1 of X is Vg of X is 1. We're talking about the volume of a convex hull in a zero-dimensional vector space, so by convention that would be 1, and so J O of F is equal to the volume in of G Q gamma 1 modulo G A gamma 1 1 simply of the integral over GA gamma 1 GA F of X to the minus 1 gamma 1 of X dx. So this is just the old invariant orbital integral that we saw right at the beginning. And so these are the terms that match those in the case of compact quotient. And there are lots of them. There are going to be lots of these terms. In GLN, they correspond to elements gamma, rational elements gamma, whose characteristic polynomial is irreducible over Q. But there's lots of other ones too, so just to draw a picture for P equals SL3, say for gamma 1 being in the opposite extreme, a diagonal element, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, where alpha I and alpha j are distinct, and this to be regarded, in other words, I want these to be rational elements, non-zero elements, and so the diagonal element, a regular diagonal element in SL3. So then this intersects the minimal parabolic subgroup. Any one of these groups P1 prime, for which we're forming the convex hull, P1 prime, that would also have to be minimal. Every one of these would also have to be minimal. And so WAP1 prime is just going to be the whole Weyl group, W0, which is S3. So you've got six elements in the Weyl group, and Vm of x is the volume of a nice little region that looks something like this. So there's minus, so we've got these minus, the minus signs, by the way, come in, if you were writing the Iwasawa decomposition as K-A-N rather than N-A-K, you'd have plus signs. The minus signs mean that these elements are more likely to occur in the positive chamber. They don't really have to be in the positive chamber for what I'm drawing, but so there's the point where S is equal to 1. And then you're going to have six other vertices that one checks. In fact, adjacent vertices are joined by a line that meets the singular hyperplane perpendicularly, like this. And so these other vertices, these correspond to the points minus S to the minus 1, HP0, WS tilde of X. That's what these different vertices are. So we're talking about the volume of that region. Something you can describe for GLN in really elementary terms, you take an element and even say just GLNR. Take an element in GLNR, look at its Iwasawa decomposition, look at its Gram-Schmidt decomposition, and look at the diagonal entries and take the logarithms of their absolute values. And that's going to give you a point in Rn. But then do the same thing in which you multiply x on the left by a permutation matrix. And you're going to get another element. So you're going to get n factorial different elements in Rn, and it's the volume of the convex hull that arises. Sorry, I'm going very fast. I want to say a few words about truncation, about the spectral side, just to set it up in a way that's parallel to what we've done so far. So there's still more. There's more to be done on the geometric side, and it's tricky. The question remains to evaluate these JOs in the remaining terms, in particular, where O consists entirely of unipotent elements. And that's another problem. I won't be able to say anything about that, but one can get a pretty good formula for it in general. But I'd like to just try to set up the spectral side in a way that's close to being parallel to the geometric side. So this whole thing is in a paper. This is still kind of like the earlier analysis. It's the analysis of the spectral side that's parallel to this analysis of the geometric side. And this is done in a paper in Compositio. I'm afraid these papers are hard to read. I hope I've learned more about writing things up in the interim, but among other things, they have a number of proofreading mistakes. I was not good at proofreading then, and there are sometimes zetas that are supposed to be mu's and so on, but they don't apparently have any serious mistakes in them. And anyway, I wish there were better references. But in any case, what I'm about to describe is in that paper. So we have a spectral expansion. Of kT of x. So all of this over there, that was figuring out kind of sort of a geometric expansion of kT of x. We have a spectral expansion, well, the geometric, we have a spectral expansion of this given by Eisenstein series. And by theorem one, this is integrable. However, kT of x, the truncation that we used to define kT of x, was really modeled on the geometric side. And the fact that we were able to kind of break up this integral into classes O pretty easily is because it was modeled on the geometric side. It's much harder to do with this particular truncation, with this particular modified kernel on the spectral side. But we do know it's integrable. What we would like to do is to write its integral as a sum of terms corresponding to individual automorphic representations. And so for that, I would like an analog for automorphic representations of this equivalence relation O that we had on classes, elements in GQ. And what it turns out to be, for these purposes, is the set of equivalence classes of pairs. P1, so this P1 in a sense is kind of parallel to the P1 that we had up there, but pairs P1, sigma, where P1 is a parabolic subgroup, and where sigma 1 is a cuspidal. I haven't defined that, but probably most of you know what it is, a cuspidal automorphic representation of MP1A. Actually, not MP1A, but MP1A1. In other words, it's an equivalence class under twisting by elements lambda. And we would say that two elements, two pairs, would be equivalent if sigma 1 prime is equal to S sigma 1 for some S in this Weyl set. Hey, P1 prime. it acts in the obvious way on representations, and so that will define an equivalence relation by this conjugate relation by the Weyl group. So this really is a natural spectral analog of all this set X of equivalence classes, and maybe I'll call them chi in one of these indexes, the indexing sets. Okay, now where they come into Eisenstein series is in the more nitty-gritty of how Langlands actually proves that main theorem. So recall that the induced representation IP lambda, this was the induced representation out of whose elements you built Eisenstein series. This acts on a Hilbert space HP. I looked back in my notes and I was horrified to see that when I didn't actually write down in my notes what HP was. I wrote down all the conditions, but I didn't call it HP. till later. I mean, I called it HP in my notes when I was talking about vectors phi in HP, but I hope I wrote it down on the board, but I guess it would be, I guess I hope when you go look back, I hope I wrote it down, but in any case, I guess you'll know what it is when you look back. So it acts on a Hilbert space HP, and part of what went into Langlands' fundamental theorem, basic theorem, was the following property that he had to do in order to prove the theorem, namely to get a decomposition. So this is a Hilbert space, and he got an orthogonal decomposition. So remember, HP was built basically by inducing the discrete spectrum from MP up to G. And the theorem, the point of the theorem is to decompose the discrete spectrum of any group, in this case MP, into orthogonal pieces that come from residues of Eisenstein series attached to cusp forms. Cusp forms, cuspidal automorphic representations occur in the discrete spectrum, but there are other representations that also occur in the discrete spectrum, which Langlands showed as part of the sort of magnificence of this theorem. He showed that they all came by residues of cuspidal Eisenstein series. So you can basically write that theorem as saying that there's a decomposition of this Hilbert space into orthogonal subspaces that have their that originate with cusp forms on smaller parabolic subgroups. So where H P chi comes from the part of the discrete spectrum of MP obtained from residues of Eisenstein series attached to chi. So, in other words, if chi does not contain a representative P1 sigma 1, where P1 is contained in M, this is by definition zero. Okay, so in any case, that means that you can take, so remember, in writing the spectral expansion of KT of X, we took an orthonormal basis of this Hilbert space. So if the Hilbert space has a direct sum of these things, you can you can assume that the orthonormal basis is a corresponding disjoint union of orthonormal bases of the orthogonal components. And then you just collect all of the components in the spectral expansion of this thing that come from orthonormal basis elements in these various subsets. And so this gives decomposition K of X and X into pieces attached, natural pieces that are attached to these equivalence classes, K chi of X and X, and a corresponding decomposition of K T of X. And then what one proves is the analog of the corresponding theorem in the geometric case, namely that not only is K T X integrable, but in fact this thing is absolutely integrable. That this thing is integrable as a double sum. So this is actually quite a bit harder than in the geometric case, because the proof of the integrability of this really doesn't have much to do with how it decomposes into chi components. This is in the paper. It's theorem 2. And it depends on a separate truncation operator, an operation that truncates not the kernel or modifies the kernel, but it actually takes an Eisenstein series and truncates it. So it requires truncation of Eisenstein series. And then in conclusion, what this allows us to do is we set J T chi of F then to be the integral over J Q mod G into G A 1 of K T chi of X dx, and then J chi of X as J chi T 1 of F. And the conclusion then is that you get, and this is really kind of like the first approximation to the explicit trace formula, but you get a sum over elements O in O of J O of F is equal to the corresponding sum over elements chi in X of J chi of F. So that what even to bring the spectral side up to the point that we got the geometric side, I would want to be able to tell you explicitly how to evaluate this, maybe for almost all chi. And what that amounts to is those chi corresponding to equivalence classes here, in which there, for any element in AP1 AP, any element here, that S sigma 1 is not equal to sigma 1. But sigma 1 is kind of regular, and as a cuspidal representation, is in general position relative to that. And if that is the case, actually you can, without too much difficulty, write down an explicit formula for that, which really is a very close spectral analog, kind of like an analytic analog of a volume of a convex hull. And it involves the intertwining operators M of S. Lambda. It's then more difficult to write, but it's known, to write an explicit formula for those things for all chi. But the one for the sort of unramified chi, that is done in this paper. Okay, I've gone over time. Now, I have not said anything about applications of the trace formula. I don't want to I don't want to put you on the spot. I could talk for 5 minutes, just in general terms, about applications of the trace formula. Or are you want to go to lunch? You're gonna have to be ready for Milne in a short time. Do you want me to just say a few words, or anybody can leave if they want. I won't feel unhappy. But so there's sort of two general applications of the trace formula. One of them, in a sense, is going to be, at least from the trace formula side, is easier. The geometric side, of course, is very difficult. But the trace formula side is to use the trace formula to relate automorphic representations to the cohomology of Shimura varieties, and more precisely, to the L-adic representations of Galois groups that occur in the cohomology of Shimura varieties. And for that, what you do is, so the trace formula side of things is really easier, much easier than the geometric side, and I think Milne has started to talk about what is known on the Shimura variety side. On Shimura varieties, what you want to do is to compare the trace formula, or rather a special case of the trace formula. So Shimura varieties are attached to a group G defined over Q, certain special group. And what the special case of the trace formula is, you choose a function, smooth function of compact support, in which you specify the Archimedean component. Now, I'm really cheating a little bit. One really needs a more advanced version of the trace formula in which you somehow make these. It's possible there's an operation that allows you to make these distributions invariant by basically taking some of the non-invariant part of the spectral side and combining it with appropriate terms on the geometric side. And if you do that in the right way, you get a related trace formula whose distributions are all invariant under conjugation and in fact do not depend on the choice of a maximal compact subgroup. But, I mean, the idea is the same. You'd specify this, in fact, to be a matrix coefficient. Now, that's, again, cheating a bit because matrix coefficients for real groups are not going to be compactly supported. But roughly speaking, you take FR to be a matrix coefficient of the discrete series representations that occur discretely locally in L2 of GR. And then these weighted orbital, the ordinary invariant orbital integrals reduce to quite very explicit form, and so do the weighted orbital integrals. They reduce to very explicit form. And the explicit form of those terms, it's really only been done, I guess, in any kind of generality in the case of invariant orbital integrals. But you compare those terms with points taken mod p on the Shimura variety, and specifically with some Lefschetz fixed point formula on the Shimura variety. Now, what's at this point not known is to make the corresponding counting with the weighted orbital integrals, these parabolic terms in the trace formula, with points at infinity somehow in some sort of compactification of the Shimura variety. But there have been steps in that direction. Goretzky, Kottwitz, and McPherson have actually found a geometric formula, purely geometric formula, which is, I guess, equivalent to this special case of the trace formula, which is going to likely to be more easy to compare with the Lefschetz, sort of a characteristic P, Lefschetz fixed point formula. I reiterate that this has been done in the case of the nice terms in the trace formula, the invariant orbital integrals, but Goretzky, Kottwitz, and McPherson have a kind of geometric formula that's equivalent to the special case of the trace formula, and in particular gives a kind of a geometric interpretation of these weighted orbital integrals. All right, so I'm not going to say any more about that. So Milne is, I think, Shimura varieties is pretty hard to get to that point, too. And so I think he's sort of talking about formulas for points mod p on Shimura varieties, and that's the data that would go into the Lefschetz fixed point formula. Now, the other application, there's a number of applications, but another sort of very big and completed application of the trace formula is to try to generalize what I said just in words near the beginning, to compare the discrete spectrum of an arbitrary group G, like the multiplicative group of a quaternion algebra, with its quasi-split, the automorphic representations of a better group, let's say G star, its quasi-split inner form, like GL2. I mean, this is really represents a kind of a deep, very, would represent a very deep reciprocity law between automorphic representations of one group and automorphic representations of another group that's gotten by this group from this group algebraically, but for which there's no sort of direct, nothing conceivably approaching any kind of direct way to compare the automorphic representations. And what you would do is, like Jacques A. Langlands did in the special case, is to compare the terms on the geometric side with the trace formula of this, with terms on the geometric side in the trace formula on that. To be more precise, what you do is you pick a function, f, and so this You assume this is a product of local functions, fv, and you'd like to define a function f star on c infinity c g star of a. Okay, so this would be a product over v of functions fv star. And you'd need to, given a test function on one group, you'd need to define a test function on the second group in order to try to compare geometric sides of the trace formulas. But if you could do that, then, and show the geometric sides matched, then you'd have a corresponding identity of spectral size from which you would try to deduce a reciprocity between their automorphic representations. However, the situation in general is much more difficult than in the case of GL2 and quaternion algebras, because G and G star are not, there is not a map from conjugacy classes over Q in here to conjugacy classes in Q over there that you'd kind of use to try to compare or to define functions by orbital integrals. The problem is you can match by invariants, things like general analogs of a characteristic polynomial, you can match conjugacy class, semi-simple conjugacy classes in GC with semi-simple conjugacy classes in G star C. But any group other than GLN has this very deep, interesting phenomenon that you could have two regular semi-simple conjugacy classes in GQ, gamma and gamma 1, in GQ, which are conjugate in GC, but which are not conjugate in GQ. And so this is observations of Langlands in the beginning of the 1970s. He called this condition of being conjugate over GC stable conjugacy. And that does not mean that they are conjugate over GQ in any group other than GLN and quaternion algebras. What you can map from one group to another is stable conjugacy classes, because you're doing mapping it by, say, the coefficients of some sort of characteristic polynomial. And that's kind of like a geometric way to measure conjugacy classes. It's insensitive to rational conjugacy classes. And so what you want to do is to compare a trace formula here with some variant of a trace formula here in which the terms depend only on the stable conjugacy classes. And this is making a long story very short. That's not true of the terms in the trace formula. They really are sensitive to the actual conjugacy classes and not the stable conjugacy classes. And so what you try to do is to take the trace formula over here and write it as a sum of other trace formulas, one of which whose terms depend only on stable conjugacy classes, and a bunch of error terms, which you then, and this is sort of partly known but partly not known, error terms which you match with trace formulas on smaller groups attached to G, groups G prime, which are known as endoscopic groups. Quasi-split groups attached, a whole family of them, of which G star is the largest, but then a bunch of other smaller quasi-split groups which represent an error term in writing the trace formula as a stable trace formula and something else. And then you would like to compare the full trace formula on G with a linear combination of stable trace formulas with appropriately transferred functions on all of the various endoscopic groups for G. Now, this will be, I hope, the topic of the lectures of Tom Hale. I think he is planning to tell you what endoscopic groups are, and to, because the definition involves a little bit of things. It's very natural, but it does involve some things. And then there to actually make the correspondence from functions here to functions on G star and more generally on G prime, to make that correspond. So what you want is then to take a local function on G and in some way use it to define a function FV prime on an endoscopic group. And you would do it by asking that some combination of linear combinations of orbital integrals of regular semi-simple elements here be equal to stable orbital integrals, that is to say, well, some sort of stable orbital integrals of functions here. And the big problem that is unknown in any, but has not been solved in any but the most simple cases, is if you try to, so there's very precise conjectures about how the orbital, how this correspondence of functions should be defined. This is a function C infinity C GQB. There are very precise conjectures about how you should, given an arbitrary function here, how you would define a function over here which is specified uniquely up to its stable orbital integrals. However, if you think about it for a moment, all right, you do that. Suppose you can do that. What you don't know is, suppose in the simplest of cases, where V is p-adic, suppose FV is the characteristic function, the property that you would insist be true almost everywhere, because you're asking for smooth functions, almost everywhere FV would be the characteristic function of the maximal compact subgroup. That's a property that's forced on you by the definition of smoothness for functions on GA. And you would want to know that if you make this transfer by orbital integrals in the conjectural fashion that's quite precise, that this actually matches, that then FV prime is the corresponding characteristic function of maximal compact subgroup of G prime V. That would be necessary because otherwise the function you get over here as an adelic function wouldn't be smooth if it almost everywhere it wasn't the characteristic function of a maximal compact subgroup. This assertion and very generalizations of it for weighted orbital integrals, and I haven't even mentioned the twisted trace formula, which would try to compare. Well, there's a twisted analog of the trace formula, but anyway, in any case, there's various generalizations of this, natural generalizations, but this is the main one. It's called the fundamental lemma. A very bad misnomer, since it's not been proved, so it can't be called a lemma. And even when it is proved, I think it wouldn't be fair to call it a lemma, because it's been a very serious conjecture for 30 years. That it will be the topic of Tom's talks, and the point of that is to put in context the beginnings of how you would want to use the trace formula in this fashion. So that's all.